بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته brothers and sisters and friends may the peace and blessings of God of Allah be upon every single one of you this video is going to be addressing the recent podcast between Dr. Jordan Peterson and the war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu and I'm going to be addressing some of the deliberate omissions the false claims and at least one false assumption that was expressed by these two individuals. Now I have put some notes together, I'm going to be referring to them inshallah, God willing. And the first thing I want to say is this. Jordan Peterson has recently displayed an immoral and inconsistent way of being. He has come across to his audiences as anti-oppression and anti-authoritarian. However, he recently invited the war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu and engaged in an interview or a discussion that can only be described as one-sided, ideological, and immoral propaganda. Now, for someone who has immense following, he has huge influence, and he has an immense responsibility to be balanced. In fact, he has an epistemic and moral duty to be informed. This is very important. Sometimes ignorance is an excuse, but not in this case, because we are talking about ethnic cleansing, oppression, injustice, and a modern-day apartheid. So, in this context, to invite a war criminal that has been responsible for crimes against humanity, human rights abuses, and injustices against Palestinians, Muslim and non-Muslim, and he has also been responsible for what many authorities are now describing as a modern-day apartheid, without holding him to account, or at least challenging him, is one of the greatest acts of cowardice and injustice that have been displayed on social media. Especially in the context of who Dr. Jordan Peterson is. He should know better. Even if Dr. Peterson does not agree with these assertions, the fact that they are expressed by mainstream academics, they exist in academic literature, they are expressed by mainstream politicians, media outlets, multiple human rights organizations and notable personalities, then he should have at least questioned him and held him to account. Given the gravity of the assertions that have been made, he should have questioned him further. He should have not just given him a platform to espouse the distortion of reality and the twisting of history and to express such immorality and one-sided ideological propaganda. Now, since Dr. Peterson did not hold him to account, then it can show, and to be fair, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it's a duck. And in this context, if it looks like a Zionist and it quacks like a Zionist, then it's a Zionist. Because if you think about it, Dr. Peterson may have a conflict of interest, right? Given the fact that he has joined Daily Wire, which is a pro-Zionist organization that is run by the genocidal apartheid apologist Ben Shapiro. So it may be the case that Dr. Peterson doesn't want to bite the hand that is currently feeding him. Now, before I share some of my thoughts and respond to some of the claims and omissions of the podcast, let me substantiate why I'm calling Netanyahu a war criminal. There are many examples, but one should suffice. Let's recall, let's go back to the 2014 crazed assault of Gaza. Over 2,100 people died, mostly innocent civilians. 60,000 homes were destroyed. Over 100,000 people were made homeless. 20,000 tons of explosives were fired into one of the most densely populated regions on earth. So he is a war criminal, brothers and sisters and friends. Now I'm going to respond to some key false claims, some deliberate omissions, and a false assumption. Now, as a caveat, I want you to please note that I'm not going to address everything because some things do not require a response. And I also believe that some things should just be laughed at because anyone with some kind of moral intelligence or emotional intelligence or social awareness will understand that very clearly. So there are 6 points I want to make. And they include addressing 2 false claims, addressing 3 deliberate omissions, and addressing 1 false assumption. So the first point is a claim, which was a land without a people and a people without a land. That's the kind of colonial Zionist myth. The second is another claim that I want to address, which is, well, the Jews simply returned to a barren land. They returned home. They returned to a place where there was no one there, maybe one or two villages. The third point is dealing with a deliberate omission. They omitted the fact of the Nakba, that there were colonizers, there were colonial settlers that came into the land, into the region, and they expelled over 700,000 Palestinians with no right to return. The fourth point is another omission, responding to another omission, and that is basically saying that it was peaceful. The Jews just came in and it was barren land, and they created a great society and they created a great nation, and there was no brutality or occupation, right? And that is obviously false. The fifth point is another omission, and they clearly are not mentioning a historical fact that there was peaceful coexistence between Arabs, Muslims, and Jews. They have deliberately omitted this. The sixth point is one false assumption, and that basically assumes that Israel is a good and decent and great country. And that's something that we're going to unpack. So let's deal with the first two claims. The first is a colonial myth, which basically says a land without a people and a people without a land. And the other claim is the Jews simply returned home, or they returned to this barren land. There was no one there, maybe one or two villages. And this is false, my dear brothers and sisters. Now, these colonial myths, brothers and sisters and friends, were known to Zionists themselves. Take, for example, Moshe Dayan. He was close to Ben-Gurion, and as you know, Ben-Gurion was the first prime minister of Israel, and he was the primary founder of the Zionist state. And Moshe Dayan was an Israeli military commander and a former defense minister. And he was addressing Technion, Israel Institute of Technology, and he is cited in 1969 to have said the following: Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You do not even know the names of these Arab villages, and I do not blame you because geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. Nahlal arose in the place of Mahlul, Kibbutz Gvat in the place of Jipta, Kibbutz Sarid in the place of Hunayfis, and Kefar Yehoshua in the place of Tal al-Shuman. There is not one single place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population. Shame on you, Benjamin Netanyahu and Dr. Jordan Peterson. Another Zionist, Arthur James Balfour, who was the Prime Minister of the UK and the Foreign Secretary in the Lloyd George Ministry, and he issued the Balfour Declaration of 1917 on behalf of the cabinet, which supported a home for the Jewish people. Now, this is what he had to say. He said, and he admitted in Palestine, that the Arabs were the indigenous majority population. These are his words: indigenous majority population. You have another Zionist, Israel Zangwill, who was a British author at the forefront of cultural Zionism during the 19th century and was a close associate of Theodor Herzl. In 1897, Zangwill visited Palestine and saw for himself the indigenous population there. So in 1905, at a Zionist speech in Manchester, Zangwill said the following: Palestine proper has already its inhabitants. The Peshalik of Jerusalem is already twice as thickly populated as the United States, having 52 souls to the square mile, and not 25% of them Jews. Also, my dear brothers, sisters, and friends, connected to this claim is the Zionist myth or false assertion that often argues that Palestine, as a region with this name, was taken by Arab conquerors. They claim that Palestine was put under the control of the Arabs after the Arab-Muslim conquest of the 7th century. This is false. Long before Islam even existed, Arabs lived in Palestine. The Arabization of Palestine was done by Arab Christians hundreds of years before the rise of Islam. Herodotus was the contemporary of Socrates, and he's referred to by Cicero as the father of history. He wrote a book entitled histories. And it was written between 450 to 420 BC. And in this book, Herodotus details his own visit to a land called Palestine. And Herodotus describes Palestine geographically as a country known today. And listen to this. He says the seaports of Palestine were occupied by Arabs who controlled the incense trade. This is around 450 to 420 BC, my dear brothers and sisters and friends. And you have an academic, David Ashery, professor of ancient history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He acknowledges that during Herodotus' time, Arabs lived in Palestine, but there were only a few Jews there. Nowhere does Herodotus mention Israelites in Palestine. And you have many ancient figures who refer to Palestine as a distinct region. These include Aristotle, Strabo, Pliny the Elder, Pomponius Mela, Ammianus Marcellinus, etc., etc., etc. The key point here is Palestine existed before 630 AD and it was under Arab rule hundreds of years before the so-called Arab Muslim conquest. Now, more remarkable is what archaeology has discovered. Now, the mortuary temple of Ramses III at the Medinet Habul Temple in Luxor is one of the best preserved temples in Egypt. In the temple, an inscription dated 1150 BC refers to Palestine. And you have an early Assyrian tablet dating from 717 BC speaks of how Palestine was incorporated into the Assyrian Empire. Now, numismatics is the study of coins and it can tell us a lot about history. Now, in the 6th to the 4th century BC, Palestine had its own coinage and currency known as the Philisto-Arabian coins. This shows the economic prosperity and autonomy of Palestine during the time. Now, the point is very clear. The Arabs existed in Palestine before Islam. And there are many other examples to cite, but here's another one. The Council of Chalcedon, held in 451 AD. As many of you know, it established the two natures of Jesus, according to the Christian biblical perspective, that he was both man and God. Now, the city of Gaza in Palestine was represented at the Council of Chalcedon by an Arab bishop. In fact, brothers and sisters and friends, historically speaking, the Byzantine emperors of Constantinople were the ones who appointed Arab kings as rulers of Palestine. Emperor Justinian named Abu Karim ibn Jabala as the ruler of Palestine. So now, brothers, sisters and friends, let's deal with the next two points, which are two omissions. And the first omission is the omission of the Nakba. They have omitted that the Nakba happened, the catastrophe, the fact that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were expelled from their homes with no right to return. The second omission we want to address here is the brutality and immoral foundations of the occupation of Palestine. Let's start with the Nakba. Now, the Nakba literally means disaster, catastrophe, or cataclysm. And it's also known as the Palestinian catastrophe. And this was the destruction of Palestinian society and homeland in 1948, and the permanent displacement of a majority of the Palestinian Arabs. And remember, they had no right to return. And to summarize the Nakba, I'm citing Ahmed Hamouda. He wrote an article for Islam 21c recently. Please read it. And it is called Uncovering the Unabashed Lies Between Peterson and Netanyahu. He writes, over 700,000 were expelled from their homes. 600 villages were burned to the ground and water wells were poisoned to prevent Palestinians from returning. Arab village names were Hebraized and modern Hebrew language and customs were practically invented from the language and customs appropriated from the locals. Until the modern day, the policy of ethnic cleansing, land appropriation, killing and Hebraization continues. More than 78% of Palestinian land has been confiscated, alongside its water resources, livestock, buildings, and fertile earth. The rest is under militarized occupation. Forget leaving it barren. Palestinians in many cases are prohibited from growing crops in swathes of their own land in the West Bank if it is too close to a Zionist illegal settlement. More than 60% of the West Bank remains under exclusive Zionist control, even if owned by Palestinians, and is designated as a firing zone for Zionist military training. Also, my dear brothers, sisters and friends, let's not forget the immoral and brutal foundations of Israel. Now, in the book, The Israeli Lobby and US Foreign Policy, John Mersheimer and Stephen Walt, they actually describe the brutal and immoral foundations of the Zionist entity, and they cite Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel and its primary national founder. And what I'm going to read to you now is actually disgusting. It's disgraceful and it's shocking. So these authors write, "This same scholarship," and they're referring to Israeli scholarship, "also reveals that the creation of Israel in 1948 involved explicit acts of ethnic cleansing, including executions, massacres, and rapes by Jews. Of course, Zionist leaders did not tell their troops to murder and rape Palestinians, but they did advocate using brutal methods to remove huge numbers of Palestinians from the land that would soon be the new Jewish state." Consider what Ben-Gurion wrote in his diary on January 1st, 1948, at a time when he was involved in a series of important meetings with other Zionist leaders about how to deal with the Palestinians in the midst. "There is a need now for strong and brutal reaction. We need to be accurate about timing, place, and those we hit. If we accuse a family, we need to harm them without mercy, women and children included. Otherwise, this is not an effective reaction. There is no need to distinguish between guilty and not guilty." And let's cite Moshe Dayan again. At an oration at a funeral of an Israeli farmer that was killed by a Palestinian Arab in April 1956, said the following, "Let us not today fling accusation at the murderers. What cause have we to complain about their fierce hatred to us? For 8 years now, they sit in their refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we turn into our homestead, the land and villages in which they and their forefathers have lived." Now we are ready to respond to another deliberate omission. And what is this omission? They are omitting that there was peaceful existence between Arabs, Muslims, and Jews. And maybe this omission is basically trying to tell us there was no peaceful existence between Arabs, Muslims, and Jews. And I think this is very important because this, I feel, addresses Peterson's main issue with Islam. I don't think Peterson wants to adopt a religion or a worldview that has strong intellectual foundations alone. He wants some kind of civilizational aspect because I think he believes that the Judeo-Christian West is a successful civilizational project. And he may believe, maybe subconsciously, that Islam is a failed civilizational project. And I think what we're going to mention now actually goes to show that Islam is the successful project because the Islamic moral values, the Islamic system, the Islamic authority was the only authority that enabled Jews, Christians, and Muslims to live peacefully together in Palestine. And that shows the superiority of the Islamic worldview and the Islamic civilization. But we'll have to unpack that another time. But let's just mention a few things because I think it's very important to address this deliberate omission. Now, as another caveat, you have to understand that there are so many historical nuances and we're not here to go into a lengthy, nuanced, academic historical study about this particular issue. And I do believe that we shouldn't over-glorify our history or anyone's history because the over-glorification of one's history is a sign of a defeated mind. However, the things that we are going to mention, that I am going to mention, are things that you can connect back to the Islamic source texts, namely the Quran and the prophetic way of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. May God's peace and blessings be upon him. So, the first thing I want to do is start with the biography of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Now, Ibn Hisham, an Islamic historian, he narrates the text of the Treaty of Medina. And I'm not going to mention the whole treaty, but I'm going to mention some of it in the context of Muslim-Jewish relations. It says, "It is incumbent on all the Muslims to help and extend sympathetic treatment to the Jews who have entered into an agreement with us. Neither an oppression of any type should be perpetrated on them, nor should their enemy be helped against them. It is incumbent on the parties to treat each other sincerely and to wish each other well. None shall subject the other to oppression and injustice, and the oppressed shall be helped. Now, interestingly, Jews felt safe in Jerusalem all the way back in the 9th century. And there is a 9th century Jewish source. It's called Sefer Pitron Torah. And it says the following. The people in whose hands the temple is today, namely the Muslims, have made it into a choice, excellent and honorable place of worship. They say, let us worship the one God who created heaven and earth, to whom the creatures belong until the coming of the Messiah. And on that day, the true worship will be renewed and will be acceptable before God. Consider Benjamin of Toluda, a Spanish Jew who traveled to Baghdad in the 12th century in 1168. He described the situation of Iraqi Jewry. These are his words. In Baghdad, there are about 40,000 Jews, and they dwell in security, prosperity, and honor under the great caliph. And amongst them are the great sages, the heads of the academies, engaged in the study of law. Consider an Italian rabbi, Obadiah Yara de Bertonoro. He traveled to Jerusalem, yes, Jerusalem, in the 15th century, in 1486 CE. And he wrote a letter to his father telling him about the country and its people. And listen to this. The Jews are not persecuted by the Arabs in these parts. I have traveled through the country in its length and breadth, and none of them has put an obstacle in my way. They are very kind to strangers, particularly to anyone who does not know the language. And if they see many Jews together, they are not annoyed by it. In my opinion, an intelligent man versed in political science might easily raise himself to be chief of the Jews as well as of the Arabs. Now, the popular historian Karen Armstrong, she notes in her book, History of Jerusalem, that the Jews hailed the early Islamic conquest of Byzantine lands as a mercy from God. And this is what she says. Toward the end of the 7th century, a Hebrew poem hailed the Arabs as the precursors of the Messiah and looked forward to the ingathering of the Jewish exiles and the restoration of the temple. Even when the Messiah failed to arrive, Jews continued to look favorably on Islamic rule in Jerusalem. In a letter written in the 11th century, the Jerusalem rabbis recalled the mercy God had shown his people when he allowed the kingdom of Ishmael to conquer Palestine. They were glad to remember that when the Muslims arrived in Jerusalem, there were people from the children of Israel with them. They showed them the spot of the temple and they settled with them until this very day. In about 750, the Jewish author of The Mysteries of Rabbi Simeon ben Hoyai saw the building, the Dome of the Rock, as a prelude to the Messianic Age. He praises the Muslim Caliph as a lover of Israel and had restored the breaches of Zion and the breaches of the Temple. It is no wonder an American Jewish historian, Zion Zohar, he confirms the Jewish appreciation of the Muslim arrival in Spain. Because whether it was in Jerusalem or Baghdad or Spain, the Muslims carried the same values, the values from the Quran and the prophetic way of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And this is what Zion Zohar says. Thus, when Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar from North Africa in 711 CE and invaded the Iberian Peninsula, Jews welcomed them as liberators from Christian persecution. Born during this era of Islamic rule, the famous golden age of Spanish Jewry produced such luminaries as statesman and diplomat Hastai ibn Shaprut, vizier and army commander Shmuel Hanagid, poet philosophers Solomon ibn Gabriel and Judah Halevi, and at the apex of them all, Moses bin Maimun, also known among the Spaniards as Maimonides. And interestingly, Maimonides, he was the physician of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. Now, having studied the Jewish history and the Jewish sentiments about Muslim compassion, the popular historian Karen Armstrong says the following, and Dr. Jordan Peterson needs to listen to this. Islam is not a failed civilizational project. Islam is not a failed civilizational project. Once we are allowed to implement these timeless values from the Quran and the prophetic way, we will establish this again. Peace and justice and harmony for all people, Muslim, Christians and Jews. Which is something that is not happening today under liberalism, secularism or Zionism. In actual fact, liberalism, Zionism and secularism are the failed civilizational projects because they have not been able to bring Christians, Muslims and Jews together living peacefully in Palestine, in Jerusalem. But it was under Islam, under Islamic values, under the successful civilizational project called Islam that was able to do that. And listen to what Karen Armstrong says. She says the Muslims had established a system that enabled Jews, Christians and Muslims to live in Jerusalem together for the first time. So let's deal with the final point, which is a false assumption. That Israel is a good country. It's a decent country. Now, by the way, I'm not passing comment on its citizen. This is a comment on the authority of Israel, the Zionist entity, the political structures. And there's so much to say, but I'll briefly just mention the fact that Israel, the Zionist regime, is actually brutal and it is facilitating apartheid and it is not a good country. The first point, Israel has violated 28 resolutions of the United Nations Security Council, which are legally binding on member nations of the UN. Israel has violated the Geneva Convention, specifically Geneva Conventions 4, Article 33. Why? Because due to the collective punishment of the Palestinians, especially in the crazed attack of Gaza in 2014. And to add to this, we have a press release that was released on the 25th of March 2022, and it was released by the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, and it's entitled, Israel has imposed upon Palestine an apartheid reality in a post-apartheid world. And I quote, Michael Link, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territory Occupied since 1967, said the report addressed the question as to whether Israel's acquisitive and repressive practices over the course of its 50-year-old regime had curdled from an endless occupation into something darker, harsher, and more ominous. He had concluded that the political system of entrenched rule in the occupied Palestinian territory satisfied the prevailing evidentiary standard for the existence of apartheid. Yes, brothers and sisters and friends, apartheid. Another report by Human Rights Watch entitled A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution states, about 6.8 million Jewish Israelis and 6.8 million Palestinians live today between the Mediterranean Sea and Jordan River, an area encompassing Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. The latter made up of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Throughout most of this area, Israel is the sole governing power. In the remainder, it exercises primary authority alongside limited Palestinian self-rule. Across these areas and in most aspects of life, Israeli authorities methodically privilege Jewish Israelis and discriminate against Palestinians. Laws, policies, and statements by leading Israeli officials make plain that the objective of maintaining Jewish-Israeli control over demographics, political power, and land has long guided government policy. In pursuit of this goal, authorities have dispossessed, confined, forcibly separated, and subjugated Palestinians by virtue of their identity to varying degrees of intensity. In certain areas, as described in this report, these deprivations are so severe that they amount to the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. So to end, brothers and sisters and friends, I have addressed certain key claims, false claims, the deliberate omissions and one false assumption. But to conclude, and I think it's important to mention this as CEO of Sapiens Institute, that we will never engage with anyone in a neutral way if they are pro-Zionist or anti-Palestinian, and this now includes Dr. Peterson. Now, this doesn't mean we're not going to continue to give someone da'wah to share Islam with them, of course, but there are contexts and variables here. If someone is against truth, against justice, they are against the Palestinians, they are pro-Zionist, then we are going to hold them to account. And hopefully this video is just the beginning. So any engagement will be based on holding them to account, responding to any lies and injustice, and at the same time, inviting them to Islam in the best way. Masjid al-Aqsa is one of our red lines. Truth and justice is non-negotiable in Islam. Peterson has opposed truth and justice in the way that he engaged with the war criminal Netanyahu, and with the way he facilitated the twisting of reality and the distortion of history, not to mention the deafening silence of the brutality of Israel's birth and its terror of the current apartheid and ill treatment of the Palestinian people, many of which include our brothers and sisters in Islam and our brothers and sisters in humanity. And ignorance is not an excuse for such grave matters. However, Islam does allow U-turns. The door to mercy and forgiveness is always open until our last breath. Let us not forget the greatest enemies of Islam who fought and killed Muslims, embraced Islam, and were subsequently embraced by our beloved Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And let us not forget, brothers and sisters, the Battle of Uhud. Many lessons can be learned from this. But in our context, we have to understand that there was a mistake by some of the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and one can argue that that battle was lost. To the degree where the companions were killed and the beloved uncle of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was also killed and mutilated. The Prophet was injured, he was bleeding. And in that context, he was asked to invoke curse upon the polytheists. These are people who are fighting the Muslims. These are people who injured our beloved Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But when he was asked to curse the polytheists, what did he say? He said, "I have not been sent at the invoker of curse, but I have been sent as a mercy." And this can be found in an authentic hadith narrated by Muslim. Finally, brothers and sisters and friends, Palestine will be liberated whether people like it or not, whether Dr. Jordan Peterson likes it or not, or Benjamin Netanyahu likes it or not. Why? Because it is a truth. It is an inevitability. It is a guarantee from Allah Himself. We believe that the liberation of Palestine will happen. We believe this more than we believe that the world is spherical. Why? Because it has come directly from the Lord of the heavens and the earth. It is a guarantee. So I advise the likes of Dr. Jordan Peterson and Benjamin Netanyahu to be on the side of truth and justice. Be on the winning team. And Dr. Jordan Peterson, if you've listened to this video, I strongly recommend that you publish an apology for being an apologist for ethnic cleansing, for being an apologist for apartheid, and an apologist for Zionism, and an apologist for the twisting of reality and the distortion of history. Before I close, brothers and sisters and friends, and I'm addressing this to Dr. Jordan Peterson as well, here's some further reading. The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pape, The 100 Years War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi, The Israeli Lobby and US Foreign Policy by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, and a book by Noor Masalha, which is called Palestine, A 4,000 Year History. And I will provide other references and links at the bottom of this video. My dear brothers, sisters and friends, thank you very much for watching. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.